Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, I'd like to welcome you all today. Today is the last TMR program of the season. That's right, it's the end of the semester. Tomorrow is Mayfest. You don't want to drive anywhere near the university tomorrow, Friday, April 27th. Streets will be closed. Partying will be going on. But we will resume in September, and you'll have that date during the summer. However, as always, there are a lot of things going on in the community, many of which we sponsor. I want to remind you about the Intelligent Conversation series that continues next week, Wednesday night at Lemoyne, with a conversation on narrative medicine. Last night's talk, several people here in the room were there, on the future of medicine and personalized medicine was really thought-provoking. And I'm sorry you all missed it. But we do have another one next week. The Institute for Retired People goes on in May. That's a Thursday noon program. You can find the information on the University College website. The Onondaga Citizens League annual meeting is coming up June 6th. We have a very interesting speaker, Richard Ravitch, and also interesting awardee, Ralph Ketchum. Speaking of awards, Interfaith Works is Tuesday, May 15th, and our very own Minna Buck is one of those who will be recognized. Congratulations, Minna, Judge Buck, along with a few other noted community members. So, again, lots to do. Stay involved. The Metropolitan Transportation Council is having another I-81 Challenge public meeting on May 9th. There are flyers in the room and also on the website. So I also urge you to weigh in again on that issue. Today we're going to be talking about philanthropy, as you know, with Peter Dunn of the Community Foundation. But first, it is that time of the year when we give the Thursday Morning Roundtable Meritorious Service to the Community Award. The group has been doing this for many, many years, and the criteria are that it is an award to someone who goes above and beyond in providing service to the community, could be a TMR member or not, who is largely unrecognized. And I know that there are probably many of you in the room, and you're so secretive or private about it, we don't know about you. But there is one of you in the room that we do know about. And so, as always, I'm going to read the citation. Then the nominator and maybe a couple of other folks will come up and help me make the presentation to the awardee. Again, Thursday Morning Roundtable Award for Meritorious Service to the Community 2012. Today, we honor a person who is a true unsung hero. Paying it forward is how she lives her life. She puts most of her effort into the Make-A-Wish Foundation of Central New York, but she does so much more. Every time she makes a public appearance, she reminds us all that regardless of physical limitations or age, we can make a difference. She raises thousands of dollars for Make-A-Wish, usually enticing her friends to participate in selling a myriad of small items, most of which she has designed. She's also planned and created a Christmas tree for the Everson Museum Festival of Trees that she decorated to promote Make-A-Wish. Much of her work is behind the scenes, but she also welcomes opportunities for public speaking events to bring Make-A-Wish to a wider audience. Although her primary efforts are devoted to that group, she's also helped Ronald McDonald House and collected presents to donate to sick children. There are many people who have made great contributions to our community, but what makes this person stand out is that she has accomplished more than many people who are fivefold her age, as she is only 14, just had a birthday. For her contributions to the Central New York community, the Thursday Morning Roundtable is most pleased to present this award for meritorious community service to Becca Lloyd. Come on up, Becca.
Thank you.
Diane Kupperman, would you come up? There you go. Are you a little bit surprised?
I thought I was coming for Diane.
I know you did. And please, we don't usually tell fibs like this, but we like to keep it a secret. So there you go. Diane Kupperman, Make-A-Wish, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. All right. And Colleen's going to take our picture. And then maybe she'll take a few more just with Becca and Diane in front of the sign. And again, Becca, do you want to say a couple of words? Okay, give us a...
Okay. Thank you for inviting me today. The Make-A-Wish Foundation gives very sick children a wish to see, be, or to have anything they want. The hope and memories afterwards are to help the child get through their difficult treatments. I have heart problems, and I have had 5 heart surgeries. I, too, was given a wish. It was wonderful. After my wish, I decided I wanted to help kids, too. Today, I want to tell you the definition of the word compassion. Compassion, it is a deep awareness of the suffering of another, coupled with the wish to relieve it. You see, the word wish is in there. Compassion, it's not the same as sympathy, empathy, or altruism, although each of these plays a part. The compassionate person feels the suffering of another and makes positive steps to alleviate that suffering. None of you are doctors who can heal a sick child with cancer, but you can show compassion by donating to her wish to see Cinderella. None of you can pay for a 3-month hospital stay for a boy who needs a kidney transplant, but you can help him financially receive a signed baseball from his favorite Yankee player. And when he's feeling better, maybe even let him go pitch a ball at a game. You see, if you have compassion, which by definition has the word wish in it, you can have your own wish come true by helping kids have their wish comes true through Make-A-Wish Foundation. This is why I do what I do, and this is why I love Make-A-Wish Foundation. You see, my family and I have compassion for sick kids in Central New York. So, be an inspiration. As part of the community, you are all in a unique position to really make a difference. And I'm just a kid, so if I can do it, so can you. So come on, be part of something magical. I am. Thanks again.
Thank you. And again, it was a total surprise to her. So, and I want to thank her family for getting her here and helping us with this little deceit. Right now, it's my pleasure to introduce Frank Ridzey, who's the Director of Research and Community Initiatives at the Community Foundation of Central New York, who will introduce today's speaker. Thanks, Frank.
Great. Thanks, Tim. Wow, that was fantastic. Congratulations, Becca.
Yeah.
It's awe-inspiring, but at the same time, I'm a little nervous. After that subterfuge, I'm wondering, who's really supposed to give Peter's presentation? I hope this wasn't a pretext. It's a great honor and pleasure to be able to introduce Mr. Peter A. Dunn, who has been at the helm of the Community Foundation of Central New York for approximately 4 years now. His official title is President and CEO, but I like to think of him as our head coach. Why? Because that's how we act at the Community Foundation. We treat each other as members of a team, always pushing each other to better use our skills to address our 2 main challenges. Of 1, honoring our donors' intents and legacies, and 2, helping our community deal with the challenges of the future. So to be a leader for the future, what you really need is a visionary leader, and that's what we have in Peter Dunn. Pete Dunn comes to this community after starting his career in Buffalo with United Way, working with the Council of Foundations, our national affiliation organization in Washington, D.C., then after being vice president at the California Community Foundation. He comes to us also well-educated, graduate with honors, University of Notre Dame, and also having earned his JD at Buffalo Law School. So to have this visionary leader, he needs a perch, right? A good vantage point. And that he has, thanks to the work that has been done before him. As Isaac Newton once said, something along these lines, if I see further than others, it's only because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. And we do have in the room a giant, Peggy Ogden, who for 20 years, thank you, Peggy. Built the foundation not only into a very reputable and important part of this community, but also a great vantage point from which our visionary leader of today can take us into the future. So what types of things can Pete see standing upon the shoulders of Peggy? Kind of an image. Well, I'll give you just a few examples. Perhaps raising our community invested assets to the highest level ever. He's not only envisioned this, but it's already a reality. Taking the community foundation to a new home, a new building, which is meant to be a home for all nonprofit and civic organizations, many, many, many of which have already been using it as such. This, too, has been an accomplishment of the community foundation under Peter. Always giving staff the opportunity to explore and try new things, even if they might not be successful. This has become a way of life under the leadership of Peter Dunn. So without further ado, I'd like to invite this visionary leader to come up here and tell us a little bit about what he sees for the future.
Well, let me tell you, there are a bunch of really wonderful things about my job. But one of the greatest things about my job are the colleagues that I have, and Frank is a phenomenal example of that, someone who is and remains a professor at Lemoyne, but has changed his career to add to the civic dynamism of Syracuse through the Community Foundation. I'm a little bit circumspect about following Becca. I think there's isn't there a movie thing about being in movies with kids and animals? That said, you definitely have a future for you in public speaking, let me tell you. I've been here 4 years. I came here from Los Angeles, and one of the things that's always remarkable to me is I have this little trick. I'll run into somebody and I'll say, oh, yeah, I moved here from Pasadena 4 years ago, and they look at me with these big eyes, and they're like, are you crazy? You moved here from Los Angeles? I was like, I grew up in Buffalo. They're like, oh, you get it. I understand why you moved here. You know, so I sometimes think that we'll know when Syracuse hits an inflection point in terms of its self-image of itself, when the response to that isn't, oh, you're crazy, but, oh, isn't that cool that you moved here? 4 years ago, my children were 4 and 2. Now they're 6 and 8. And at that time, you know, they didn't have a lot of choice about where we were going to live. But coming back upstate was a really compelling thing for my wife and I. And I said to our girls, you know, we're moving to Syracuse, and there's snow there, and it's different. You've never seen snow except up at the mountains in Los Angeles. And my older one said, yay, I get to build a snowman. And my younger one said, I don't want to move to Silly Goose. The younger one, who's now 6 the other night, said as she was going to bed, Daddy, did you know how hard it would be to be a parent before you had kids? So she's gotten a little bit more profound in 4 years. So what I want to do today is several fold. I want to talk a little bit about philanthropy in general and foundations in particular. At your tables, I actually gave handouts, and one of the things I've noted, having been a frequent attendee at these presentations, is that there's lots of PowerPoints without handouts, so I hope everybody has one or you can find one. But I want to talk about foundations in general and the Community Foundation in particular to give you a sense of how we work. I often think of philanthropy sometimes as viewed externally as kind of a black box, that people don't kind of know how it works. I'm going to tell the story of the Community Foundation a bit to give you a sense of that, as well as some donor stories. I'm going to talk about two grant initiatives, one of which Frank is responsible for, as a way of talking about economic crisis response and the opportunities in philanthropy to have an impact on nonprofits. And lastly, I'm going to talk about some philanthropic trends, charitable planning, and the wealth transfer study that we recently did to give you a sense of where we see the future of philanthropy in Central New York. So I've used this cartoon a lot. Peggy's going to kill me because she sees it every time I talk. But I love it because I continue to love it because it says so much about what we do in philanthropy. Linus says to Charlie Brown, "When I get big, I want to be a great philanthropist." Charlie Brown says, "You have to have a lot of money to be a great philanthropist." After consideration, Linus says, "I want to be a great philanthropist with someone else's money." And I think it's really important to keep that in perspective. And it's something, when we think about stewardship, I think all of us in the foundation sector think of that, whether it's a family foundation or the community foundation or whatnot. But this is really key to our DNA and how we approach what we do. It's not our money. It's other people's money. This is a sampling of the foundation ecosystem. You don't often hear foundations in general talked about as a system, but I thought I'd give just a brief overview of who we are. It's not a big cohort. When we get together in a room, it's a fairly small group of folks. We get together about twice a year and just talk about where we are. But I thought you'd find this interesting. So on the left-hand side, there are the foundations that are principally involved here in Syracuse, the Community Foundation, the Allen Foundation, Reisman Foundation, Gifford Foundation, and Snow. The Gorman Foundation is a foundation in Oneida that focuses on Madison County. Emerson and Stardust are foundations focusing in Auburn and do most of the work there, not exclusively, but most of it. St. Agatha Foundation is the legacy of Lori Mesolingua, focusing on breast cancer care. The United Way is different than the foundations in that it's an annual campaign and money flows through it, but it's also a funder in human services work. There are out-of-town funders like the J.M. McDonald Foundation that derive their wealth from Cortland historically and do make some grants here, although they do work more nationally. You also see work from Ford and Casey and a bunch of other foundations that have national profiles that make grants here. And lastly, there are another 100-plus smaller foundations in town, mostly private foundations that are active. The Community Foundation is distinct in that it's a public charity. We receive gifts from lots of different individuals and manage them collectively through the funds that we administer. But we're all part of the same ecosystem. There's also differences between some of these foundations. For example, the Allen Foundation is a family foundation. The board is principally composed of family members from multiple generations. The Gifford Foundation is an independent foundation. There's no Giffords who are involved with the Gifford Foundation, for example. So what is a community foundation? Fundamentally, we're a public charity. The United Way and the Community Foundation are both public charities because we receive lots of gifts from lots of different people. We exist to receive, manage, and distribute charitable funds. We're a collection of many funds with many missions and many different goals. So I like to say we have 600 funds with 600 missions and 600 goals. That's a lot of things to manage and collectively figure out what to do with. A good chunk of our money, about 60%, is either unrestricted or broadly field of interest, meaning that we can have a grant-making impact through our board to changing circumstances in Central New York that's distinct from a lot of other community foundations around the country. For instance, the Rochester Community Foundation is twice our size. We have, I think, four times as much unrestricted money. If you would add up all the unrestricted money at the community foundations in Buffalo and Rochester, we have more. But we're half the size of Rochester. So part of that is our history, and part of that is the phenomenal work of Peggy over the years. We're a convener and resource for nonprofits, and lastly, we're a resource to administer and execute personal and family philanthropic plans. Really, we have two businesses. One is about community impact, as Frank alluded to. We're about making grants. We're about convening. We're about leading change, making around initiatives that we've identified. And we're both responsive to community need, to the agencies that apply to us. A lot of individuals in this room are either on the boards of nonprofits that have applied to us, represent those nonprofits, and so forth. So you may be pretty familiar with our grant initiatives over the years. We're also about charitable fund stewardship, and that's the flip side. We're an alternative to people creating their own private foundations. We aggregate community charitable capital. If you would add up all those foundations in the two slides ago, you'd have about $400 to $500 million in charitable resources in the five-county area, and we're a quarter of it. If you would add up all the foundations in Buffalo, it's about $1.7 billion. So on a demographic basis, we have some work to do in terms of aggregating and increasing charitable capital. We're about stimulating philanthropy and endowment, promoting legacies, and honoring our donor intent. We can point to funds that were created 80 years ago that we're still doing precisely what the donors asked us to do. We can point to other funds that have changed over time because of circumstances, and we have changed with the times while honoring those donors' intents. So the first community foundations were started in 1914. We're a creature of the trust banks. We were started out of a trust bank to be a place where many different charitable trusts could be managed collectively with a community board overseeing them. Here, this community foundation was started as the Syracuse Foundation. Well, that doesn't look very good, does it? Well, it looks better on the handout. The Syracuse Foundation was started by a group of community leaders. We were one of the first 30 community foundations created in this country. Buffalo was one of the others. And so we're part of the early history of philanthropy and the notion of community foundations in this country. Today, there are almost 900 community foundations, about a $50 billion field, distributing more around $4 billion a year in assets collectively across the country and increasingly around the world. You can't see this, but you can see it on your handout, thankfully. But these are the founders of the foundation. If I had Greg Tripoli and Dennis Connors up here, they could do massive stories about a lot of these people since they're part of the history of Syracuse, but you see a lot of their names. Alex Holstein could tell us about his ancestor Adolf. Marion Fish could tell us about Stu Hancock. There are all sorts of legacies that we still hear today, from Mr. Bond to Mr. Hancock and so forth, stories about the history of Syracuse that find themselves, these men and women, in the history of Syracuse and the Community Foundation. I'm going to tell you two quick stories about donors. The first is Charles Brannick. I think folks are fairly familiar with the Brannick device, which was the thing that you measure your shoe with. Well, when Mr. Brannick passed on, his legacy came to the Community Foundation. And today we manage a multi-million-dollar fund that is a part of our community grants. So when the Salvation Army, for instance, receives a grant through our community grants, part of it may come from the Charlie Brannick Fund. Judge Hancock, Hiscock. See, that's the first correction. I'm still waiting for Sarah McElvain and what she's going to ask me. So Judge Hiscock, when he passed away, he left the home that is the Corinthian Club and the Barnes Foundation now. He left it to us. The Corinthian Club bought it from us. We used the resources to help start Hiscock Legal Aid. Following that, the carriage house that used to be behind the Barnes Foundation, the wagon wheel, when that went away and the money left over was in the Carriage House Foundation, that private foundation merged into the Community Foundation, and to this day, the ladies who oversaw the Carriage House Foundation still make grants around elder care issues. We review the grants and make recommendations to them, and they decide where to make grants around elder care each year. Two interesting stories that get to the history and legacy. Since I know that the caffeine has hopefully kicked in, this is the audience participation portion of this presentation. I'm going to ask you two questions. First, raise your hand. How many of you can name the full names of two of your great-grandparents? The full names, first and last, great-grandparents. Raise them high. How many of you can name three? Okay, less than 10 people out of an audience of about 100. What does this say? This says, depressingly, that more likely than not, you are going to be forgotten by your own family in two generations. So live it up. These two gentlemen have not been forgotten. Through the legacies that they have left to philanthropy, through the Community Foundation, their names, their vision, and their story lives on. So think about that. Where are we now? We represent about $130 million in total assets. We've had two consecutive years of all-time asset highs. I'm particularly proud of that. That's one of the metrics that we use in the Community Foundation field because after a time of significant economic volatility, we're vibrant, we're growing, and we continue to grow and be a force for good. We're the largest local foundation with about 600 funds under management. Those funds are hugely distinct because they range in size from $2,500 at the smallest to $20 million at the largest. So there's a huge economic diversity within the funds that we manage. We have made more than $100 million in grants since our inception. So if you were to talk about sustainability, we manage $130 million, but we've made more than $100 million in grants. So that is an interesting throughput when you think about it from a financial standpoint. There's a lot of complexity, which I'm going to get to. We distributed 1,700 individual grants last year, about $6 million, to 750 charities. The preponderance of that, not all of it, but the preponderance here locally. We focus on Onondaga and Madison counties, but we also do work in Cayuga, Cortland, and Madison counties increasingly, and we're getting more and more demand to be involved regionally. You can't see this, but you can on your handout. You see our total assets. You see, I was alluding to the fact that we have a fair amount of unrestricted funds. We also have donor-advised funds where our donors are recommending our grants. About 1,500 of those grants last year were donor-advised grants. Designated funds are funds restricted for particular charities or scholarships. We are the largest scholarship provider outside of universities locally. So you can see also that the grants that we make, a little less than half are donor-advised grants. So by assets, donor-advised funds are only 20%. By grants, they're almost 40%. So there's a lot of pass-through with donor-advised funds. But that gives you a sense of the differentiation of the different types of funds that we manage. We are a big, big advocate for the notion of endowment. We believe endowment is a crucial part of sustainability, both for a community and organizations in general. We use a 5% payout, looking back over 20 quarters, to determine our average and how we distribute funds. What is interesting to me is that over the last 4 years, our grant-making budget has stayed the same. So at a time of declining government support, declining corporate support, declining support of annual funds in other ways, we have remained the same. So if there ever was an argument about why having a strong community foundation is important for the nonprofits in the community, having that continuity during a time of economic crisis, I would submit, is one of them. This is an example of one fund. It's a legacy from a woman who left us a gift many decades ago. And this fund is currently about $1.2 million. The red line that you see is the asset balance in the fund that varies from year to year. The blue line is the cumulative total of grants that have been generated by the fund during its history. As you can see, the blue line exceeds the red line significantly now after a significant amount of time. So that is, to us, an indication of why permanent charitable capital is such an important part of the ecosystem of philanthropy locally. We manage a lot of complexity. My management team doesn't like it when I say this, but there are lots of different ways that we can screw up. For those of you that are donors, we produce quarterly statements for our donors. We process all these different checks. We have all these different checks coming in that go to all these different funds that have all these different purposes, that do all these different things, that are invested in different ways. So there's lots of different opportunities that we might do something wrong. Fortunately, we don't, by and large. Not that we don't make mistakes, but generally we do a really good job, I think. Community grants, the blue part, that is the community responsive part of what we do. It's about $2 million-ish a year. excuse me. We make grants three times a year in Onondaga and Madison counties. Right now we have about 34 grants pending in our current round that we decide in June. Those grants lately have been anywhere from a 50 to 30% success rate as nonprofits apply to us, and those grants range in size from 2,000 to 150 grand. Initiatives are things that the foundation and its board have decided are important. Literacy has been a main driver. Ginny Carmody is here from the Literacy Coalition. That's a part of our literacy work has been the creation of the Literacy Coalition. Significant work over the last 6 or 7 years. We are intensely interested in nonprofit partnerships and collaborations. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And we also sponsor affiliates like our Women's Fund. We are the home of the Women's Fund. The Women's Fund makes its own grants, but we're their back office. Same with our regional funds in Cayuga and Pulaski and other places. Donor-advised grants go all over the place. They can be here, they can be in Florida, they can be a variety of different places. But donor-advised funds are essentially private foundation alternatives. 200 individuals, families, and businesses use us as their philanthropic home, and we are their manager of their giving on an ongoing basis. That's a significantly increasing part of our work. And then scholarships. We manage more than 100 scholarships, some for school districts. We're also the home of the Say Yes Scholarship Endowment. Mary Ann Schmick-Harry was here last week. I'm really proud of our role in this, in that we cut all the scholarship checks to the kids graduating from Syracuse City School District. So that's our role in the partnership. We made our largest grant ever, $1 million, in support of Say Yes Scholarships. We'll be the home of the endowment that supports that. We view it as transformational work, and we're glad to be a partner in it. There's lots of different things that we do, and one of the things I try to think about is how they're aligned. Overall, we really focus on the nonprofit sector. How do we help nonprofits? And there's lots of different things that we could do that I could spend a lot of time on talking about that. But we are, our grants are aligned with the notion of empowering nonprofits to be able to do their missions. And there's lots of different strategies that we undertake to do that. It is a perfect storm for nonprofits at the moment. We see it in the projects that we receive, in the budgets that we review. This is a survey that was done by the Nonprofit Finance Fund just this month. 85% of nonprofits report an increase in demand. 50%, less than 50% of those who receive government contracts get those payments on time from the government, which functionally means that nonprofits are floating loans to the governments in lieu of waiting for their contract payments to be received. Less than 50% have less than 3 months cash on hand, and 31% have deficits. So a third of the nonprofits nationally, according to this survey, had deficits. Scary stuff. We can't be in the business of funding nonprofit deficits. We want to be in the position of funding nonprofit sustainability. So that's an interesting place to be. There have also been some fantastically creative responses. The nonprofit field is a really creative place to be. 50%, even in this time, have added programs, staff, and other activities. They've partnered. They've merged. They've relied on volunteers. They've found ways to reduce administrative costs. So it's not a universally bleak picture, but it's a tough picture, especially for nonprofits that rely on government aid. We heard from our auditor that the New York State, in the way that it deals with Medicaid, nonprofits that do Medicaid work, principally disabled populations and others, they're going to reduce the number of contracts that they have. It's going to mean some really interesting change in the nonprofit ecosystem in the coming years. So, performance management. This is an example of a grant initiative that we undertook. To be honest with you, this derived because in one quarter, it was a couple years ago, we had a bunch of really bad grant applications, and we had some extra money. Really bad meaning they either weren't sustainable, they didn't have good outcomes. It just wasn't a good fit. It wasn't a good investment from our board's perspective. So we had some extra money in our grant-making budget. We decided, because of some of the inspiration we took, the Obama administration had the Social Innovation Fund, which made grants nationally. A major one of those went to Erie, Pennsylvania, to the community foundation there around capacity-building work. What is interesting is there was a lot of emphasis on outcomes, scalability, and being able to demonstrate impact by measuring it. Okay, this is what we did. And there's a distinction both in government funding and foundation funding now between outcomes and outputs. Outputs are we serve this many homeless people. Outcomes are this many people are no longer homeless. Okay, so that's a distinction that a lot of funders are looking at. And federally, that's what you're seeing. So we decided to create a grant cohort and make grants to nonprofits for data, systems, and measurement so that they could demonstrate that they were having effective outcomes that would then allow them to be better capable of getting funding from other sources, from the government and from other funders. So we put $200,000 into this. And in addition to just making grants to a series of nonprofits, some of which are in the annual reports that are on your tables, we also developed a learning cohort. So it was grants plus. So the 12 nonprofits were getting together once a month to learn about spreadsheet development and how to measure impact and how to use that data and manipulate it in a way that told the story of their impact. That has been really interesting to us because it's been a different model for how to do grants. It's not just cutting a check. It's a learning group that worked over a year with our staff, Frank being the inspiration for this, plus the consultants. So it's a grantee participatory model that we're going to replicate now and do another iteration of because we're really happy with the results. Strategic partnerships. You know, this group in particular, I know, is sympathetic around the notion of government consolidation because we hear it all the time from OCL and other reports from the folks that talk. Well, what about nonprofit consolidation? A couple of years ago, I think in late 08, early 09, the funders, some of the folks who were in that little chart I mentioned before, were meeting with the county to talk about county budget shortfalls. The county was going to focus on food, safety, and shelter and be a have to cut other things. So what did that mean for the funders? We couldn't gross up the other nonprofits. We didn't have enough money. But what change could we impact? The community found it, and you had lots of funders with lots of different emphases and doing lots of different things. What could we do? So we decided, in talking with our board, given the prior capacity building efforts that we were engaged in, to focus on partnerships. We wanted to incentivize, grease the skids on mergers, consolidations, regionalizations, back office partnerships, anything that drove change, either drove agencies together or drove them to think about their economic models, their regional service areas, and so forth differently. So far, we've funded 5 mergers and 2 regionalizations, and we have another 10 things in the pipeline, one of which is a merger between 3 organizations. This work has been fantastically interesting to us on a number of levels. Mergers are not the answer to every problem in the nonprofit world. They require tremendous courage, because when you think about mergers, number one, somebody's not going to have a job. Number two, you're talking about charitable mission. It's one thing to talk about a for-profit merger. With the nonprofit merger, you take all the dynamics of a for-profit merger and add on charitable mission and all the anxieties that come from that and all the identification that people have. But consolidation is going to happen, and people either need to get in front of it and drive it in a way that is to their benefit, or it's going to hit them like a Mack truck. So we want to grease the skids and help people get to where they need to be. They decide where they're going to go. We help fund it. So what is the context for strategic partnerships? You've got government contract cuts. You've got nonprofits with deficits striving for sustainability. More than 60% of nonprofit CEOs are going to retire in the next 5 years. Our view is a lot of nonprofits have a choice between mission and vehicle. You may not be able to preserve both. In our view, mission is sacred, vehicle is not. The Community Indicators Project that we undertook in partnership with Focus is an example of trying to drive data and consensus around data, and that's another piece of our work that we do in partnership with SU and a bunch of others. I don't have a lot of time to get into that. Just suffice to say that CNY Vitals is a cool site and you should look at it. Current trends in philanthropic planning, since I've been given a 5-minute warning that I'm going to take to 10, because I need to. What are some trends that we're seeing? First, private foundation terminations. We've had 6 private foundations merge into us in the last 3 years, and we have another 2 or 3 in the pipeline. So individuals are thinking about the vehicles that they manage and using, and increasingly they're becoming part of us. The notion of Warren Buffett has been talking about, I want to leave enough money to my kids, but not so they can do anything, but not so much that they'll do nothing. That has been fantastically motivating for a lot of folks. I was sitting with a potential donor a couple days ago, and a very successful professional, about giving a gift of real estate and potentially an estate gift. And when I talked about that, his eyes totally rang up because he couldn't identify with giving huge amounts of money to his kids, but he could to the community or to helping mobilize them to be engaged in the community. The fear of living too long. Jen Owens, who's here, our development vice president, has been doing a lot of work with donors around the notion of storytelling and their mission. I can tell you, I sat with a donor who came to our office and looked around, shook the table once with his estate planning advisor and said, you know, you're going to be me when I'm gone. So I wanted to see what you were about. Peter Drucker, who I trust everybody here knows who he is, was a donor to the California Community Foundation in Los Angeles when I was there. And he actually, before he died, he did a retreat with our board. And one of the things that Peter Drucker said was, you're going to be me when I'm gone, and hopefully I'm not going to look stupid when I'm gone. And I'm trusting that the Community Foundation will make me look smart. That is what we're about in terms of legacy preservation. The last thing I'd say here, and I could talk for an hour on this, is donors planning gifts around future concerns. We had a donor who left us her estate. It's about $1 million, life insurance, retirement plan, and other things, stock. And her fund had 3 points of view, 3 things that it was going to do, our general community grant making and 2 small education charities. Between the time she died and the time her estate settled, one of those small education charities in another state went bankrupt. If she had left the estate directly to that charity, it would have been sucked away by creditors. Instead, it's still an endowment supporting the other things that she envisioned. So increasingly, we're sitting with people thinking, okay, what is the charitable community going to look like in 50 years? I don't know. Therefore, the Community Foundation becomes a compelling conversation for folks. There's a big generational transition happening. Over the next 10, 20 years, a whole generation is going to pass. What is going to happen to the assets in that generation in Central New York? How much of it is going to stay here? How much of it is going to go to kids and other communities? How much of it will go to philanthropy? It's a key question for us. We did a wealth transfer study that looked at the wealth of Central New York. The mechanics of it are fairly straightforward. It's been done in many other communities. If you were to look at the total wealth in Central New York, add up all the households, all the money, all the retirement plans, business interests, everything, housing, $57 billion. It sounds like a lot of money. It also looks on a per capita basis less than what you might see nationally, but it's still $57 billion. Over the next 10 years, $22 billion will transition from one generation to the next. How much of that will stay local? An interesting question, I think. This shows county by county, so you get a sense of the wealth dynamics from county to county. I've been giving this a more in-depth conversation around this county by county. I did one down in Cortland recently. You know, did the folks in Cortland know that $1 billion is going to transfer over the next 10 years? It's an interesting question when you think about it locally on a micro basis. If that $20 billion was put into an endowment, it would generate $1 billion a year. It doesn't have to go in our endowment. Certainly like it, but doesn't have to. But that would generate $50 million a year, 10 more community foundations, if you can get a sense of that. And that's only if 5% of the total assets that are going to transfer over the next 20 years went to philanthropy. A lot of the estates we receive are all or half, significant chunks. So if just 5% of the wealth went to philanthropy, that's what kind of result we would get. Frank alluded to the new building. You know, we decided to buy this building in March 2009. Those of you who remember looking at your retirement plan statements in March 2009, you can recall that was a really bad time. That was the trough in the market. And our board had the unanimous confidence to proceed to do this. I know that the history of community foundations really well, having been in this field since 1993. And this type of activity, this building, if you went to Providence, Rhode Island, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Erie, Pennsylvania, Rochester, a bunch of other cities, you'd see similar things. So this is not done in a vacuum. It's a trend. How can a community foundation create a center of philanthropy where lots of different things can happen, where things can be convened, where nonprofits can gather, where other funders can gather? And this is what this building has done for us. It has been space-matching mission. It's been a really fantastic opportunity for us, I think, to raise our visibility as a philanthropy, to offer neutral, safe space for nonprofits to have board and staff retreats and fundraising events and other things. And we have been really proud to be able to say that we recycled more than 1 million pounds of material out of this building as part of the process, and we're on target for LEED Silver. So it is a building that is environmentally sustainable, recycling in a building that a lot of people loved and a lot of people went through during their time here. And it's also done a lot for us from a mission perspective, and it's also financially on target for where we expected it to be. I talked about a lot of things in a fairly short time, and I think I might have even met my five-minute warning. There's a lot of things that we do, and I'm happy to answer any question about what we're up to, the grants that we make, the donors we work with, our investments.
Thank you, Peter. All right. No, we're good. We have about 15 minutes for questions. So we have about 100 people in the audience. Let's see. Not quite one per person. Arlene.
What are your administrative costs in terms of your function and what goes out? Because I know lots of phone calls, lots of charities ask for money, and the proportion for their administrative is quite large.
We have 15 staff people. We operate in part, our unrestricted assets allow us to subsidize some of our work. A part of them are treated as operating endowment. We also charge a fee on funds that we manage of 1%. Our total operating costs are around 1.4%-ish of assets. So our total budget is around $1.7 million. So we operate on a fairly thin margin when you look at it in terms of total assets.
Well, we're going to get in a question from Sarah, that's for sure. But as you manage your unrestricted funds, a lot of times we hear in the community that vision is so important. There's a lack of vision. There are too many visions. When you're deciding how to target those funds, do you look at either what local government or what the Gifford Foundation or the United Way or others, do you get together, or how do you respond to?
Well, that's such a complex thing because there's a lot of different things that we have to deal with. Number one, while we have unrestricted funds, some of them have very specific things. Like, for instance, we have a fund that's for water quality and guide dogs. Okay? We manage to get grants for things around those issues, but sometimes we don't. And also we have funds for childhood illnesses and so on and so forth. There's a long spreadsheet about yay wide with all these different columns where we have to mix and match grants and purposes. We also have our general unrestricted funds. I'd say a couple of different things. Number one, our board reaffirmed the notion of us as a responsive funder. That if you were, a bunch of our funder friends have been able to focus either, for instance, in Gifford's case, on neighborhoods or capacity building. In the Allen Foundation's case, sometimes on healthcare issues. In Auburn, on Auburn issues. So we view ourselves as a responsive funder. And so I had another chart up here before that I didn't show. About two-thirds of our funds are responsive to nonprofits coming to us with their thing, whatever it is. We have set priorities within that. We like collaboration. We like sustainability. We like nonprofit change. We like diversity. So that we have overriding themes that we like within the responsive grants that we make. The other third of our funds are foundation-led initiatives. We view the literacy as foundational to lots and lots of different things, whether it's childhood literacy, ultimately resulting in graduation or not, and employment. Those sorts of issues where we find really compelling as a kind of meta issue that addresses lots of other social ills. Similarly, nonprofit collaborations are another significant theme that we've been funding. So the response is we view our role as being responsive to current and changing nonprofit needs and also finding interesting opportunities where we think we can have an impact beyond that.
Thank you.
One of the things I've noticed going on in this community is that the big agencies are so stretched with the resources that they can no longer incubate little agencies with little ideas in neighborhoods. And what does the Community Foundation see as their role in supporting and developing a grassroots innovative programs that serve specific needs?
We do a couple of things. Number one, we have a program called TLC, the Learning Class, the Leadership Classroom, thank you, that is designed to be a year-long leadership program for grassroots leaders in the city. What is interesting, too, is when we do that, the Gifford Foundation does a lot of work around small grants in neighborhoods, so it complements each other in some nice ways. We're helping train leaders. Gifford may be helping to fund programs that they want to implement. We also fund nonprofit sabbaticals. We fund advancement. We fund a variety of things within nonprofits to help them grow their internal leaders. Incubating small programs, that's a really interesting area. In some communities, there is a nonprofit incubator where small projects can be funded or live within another nonprofit space. We often see nonprofits that arguably, probably, shouldn't have been created as separate C3s. People went ahead and created their own C3 because they had a great idea, and now they can't pay for themselves. And then somebody has to pay to shut them down. It's a problem. People have vision. Being able to execute it within as a partner with others is a challenge sometimes. We often encourage that. You touched on an interesting and sometimes tough area.
My question goes to proportionate amount of funding for repeats, I guess, as opposed to one-shot deals in terms of supporting a particular organization. How much goes toward every year you're going to support this one particular group, as maybe United Way might do, to a certain level that they know they can count on that funding, and that almost is supporting that particular organizational purpose?
I would say we have a fundamentally different point of view in how we do our work. So we don't do repeat grants. Nonprofits don't come to us for continual operating funding. So we don't fund operations by and large. We don't make grants year after year to year to the same group for the same purpose. Now, the Everson might come to us for different projects from year to year, but they don't necessarily get funded every year. We don't have a fund that just, this is how much we're going to give to the Everson, this is how much we're going to give to Arise, and so on and so forth. So we respond to the nonprofits. We don't allocate to specific nonprofits for specific activities. So we view our role as being responsive to nonprofit needs on an ongoing basis. It's a challenge, though, since we don't fund operating costs. We fund programs, capital needs, capital projects, capacity building activities, things around some of the initiatives I talked about. Some foundations and some communities do fund operating costs, but they do so with a very specific method in mind around community change around a particular issue. The issue of funder support for operating costs is an interesting thing that's in development that a lot of folks talk about in philanthropy. But we're fundamentally different. United Way does its allocations on a three-year basis, and they would say they don't fund operating, they fund program. We fund quarterly. And actually, we will not make another grant to an organization through our competitive rounds until that a previous grant has been closed out. So functionally, that may mean it takes a year for a program to be executed on, and maybe 18 months before they can come back to us. Otherwise, you get this double-dipping problem, and we're very conscious of that.
You really struck a chord with me about all those people who want to start a not-for-profit. I'm executive director of a not-for-profit, a small one that's existed for 20 years, but people think it's easy. I do feel, though, that United Way is not friendly to the not-for-profits that have an ongoing budget of under $100,000 and can't meet their very stringent requirements. I would like to see you, I know you're going into this working together merger thing, I'm on one of the boards of that, but try to focus in on specifically what can you do to support the not-for-profits that are under $100,000, because we can't buy the kind of technical assistance that we need, and I think that would be a new direction you should look in to follow through on what you're doing now to try to make mergers and acquisitions.
Sure. A couple of things in there. Number one, I'd encourage TMR to have Frank Lazarski at some point, because I can't speak to you how United Way makes its funding decisions. Secondly, we have, with a fair amount of frequency, funded small organizations. We don't have a preference necessarily for large ones. We have a preference for outcomes and sustainability. And so with that, and Peggy could probably talk about legions of small grants that had big impacts over the years for small organizations.
Technical assistance.
So, number one, we don't have a bias against small agencies, I would say, number one. Number two, we've also started doing ongoing seminars in our building. So every month we're having a seminar. I just did one on an endowment building that was overflow in our building. Every month we're doing something. We have one, a three-part one on succession planning coming up in June. So every month we're doing, I think we're kind of filling a void around nonprofit management. There isn't a nonprofit management center here, per se, right? In Los Angeles, we had a nonprofit management center. It could barely keep its doors open because of its operating model, and that's Los Angeles. So here we don't have one. We're not the nonprofit management center. We do have some expertise, or we have access to consultants and other things that we can deploy. And so we've started doing these seminars as a means of kind of broadening our reach beyond grants. So that's another thing that we do. But I want to, and I'll say it again, we like making grants to small agencies because for a small grant, we can have a big impact.
Peter, you've been here for 4 years now, and seeing the slide presentation, I sense a caretaker-style general improvement of the performance of things. 4 years from now, is that presentation going to differ greatly, or is it going to just continue along the same path?
Well, I guess I'd push back against the caretaker notion. 2 years ago, we had $80 million in assets, and now we have 130. So we went from 120 to 80 to 130. So I view our asset maintenance and growth, I don't view that as caretaker. I view that as prudent management through a difficult time. Secondly, we've had 2 years in a row, not to sound defensive, but we've had 2 years in a row of really good development results where new funds have been created. I think, honestly, we do need to grow. If we want to have the change, if we want to be able to make the change that we would like to be able to make as stewards of funds and as partners with the nonprofit community, I would say we need to grow. We need to help fully fund the Say Yes Endowment. We need to see an increase in estate gifts that come to the foundation. We need to see more private foundations become partners with us. We've been in a strategic planning mode. I would say that the community foundation asset-wise needs to get significantly bigger for us to have that impact. What's going to happen, though, in the near term is that's going to mean a lot of donor-advised funds. So it's going to be us partnering with donors to achieve community good. Over time, estates will come in that will also result in flexible funds that we can deploy strategically in the nonprofit community. So that's a roundabout way of saying, I think we've done a good job of thinking carefully about our role, stewarding the assets that have been entrusted to us, growing at a time of great adversity when nobody else is really growing, and also being able to exercise different tools that we haven't always used in different ways, like the building or like nonprofit collaborations and so forth. So that's a long-winded way of saying I think we're moving forward.
What sorts of college degrees do you need to work at the foundation?
Well, I'm a recovering lawyer, if that's in any indication. And I've been through a 12-step program. We have two lawyers on our staff. We have a couple of CPAs. We have a person like Frank Rizzi, who has a PhD from the Maxwell School at SU. I have two other people who either have graduate degrees from Syracuse University from the Maxwell School or are working on them. What is interesting about philanthropy is that you will find people from everywhere. People don't just go into philanthropy out of college. They typically come from someplace else. And to give you an example, John Eberle, who's our vice president for grants, was at the rescue mission for a dozen years. So he worked with homeless people. His background is in ministry. So he has a degree in divinity, in religion. Jen Owens maybe is the exception in this case, because Jen has a liberal arts undergraduate degree and worked for two private foundations in D.C. before coming over here. But she also worked in retail, just like I did. Our Mary Meyer, who's our vice president for finance, has a JD, a law degree, and a CPA. We have other staff who have a variety of different degrees. You find people with a lot of I'd like to think that in philanthropy you have people with a lot of intellectual curiosity, people who like lots of different things. If you work for some foundations, they're almost academic because it's so focused on a particular thing. So if I worked for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, it's all about healthcare. I mean, I've got people that have, there'd be people that have master's degrees in public health and medicine and all sorts of stuff. Community Foundation, we're a responsive funder, so by nature we have to be interested in lots of different things, whether it's the arts or health or kids or whatever. So you have to be intellectually flexible enough to know lots of different things and be able to meet people where they are. I hope that's responsive. Basically, it means that you need to do well in school and you need to go to college, take a couple years, do something cool, go get a graduate degree if you're inspired to do that, and then you may find your way into philanthropy.
Thank you for that question, Becca. Thank you for your answers, Peter. Again, I want to congratulate Becca Lloyd, who's the recipient of this year's TMR, Meritorious Service to the Community Award, and also congratulate her family as well. And thank you, Peter, and I hope everyone has a lovely summer.
Thanks.